Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When Deborah Treisman took over as fiction editor at New Yorker magazine, one New York paper referred to her as that person controlling the velvet rope at the gateway to literary stardom. Cool job. But it also comes with its share of pressure. See, the people who don't get published will conclude the new editor has no taste or can't manage her office. And those who do get published, well, they don't say anything. But that's what every editor faces. What's different about this job is that it is The New Yorker, a magazine with a 78-year history of showcasing some of the best fiction to be found anywhere. New Yorker developed its literary mythology in the gray flannel and pipe tobacco atmosphere of Harold Ross, James Thurber, and E.B. White. The fiction in New Yorker files is that of Philip Roth, J.D. Salinger, and Dorothy Parker. And it means so much to be in those pages that back in 1964, when the writer John Cheever was offered $24,000 from the Saturday Evening Post, 10 times what he was making at the New Yorker, still, he chose to stay with Eustace Tilley, that high-collared, high-society man with the top hat and the monocle. The latest issue of the New Yorker is the first full look at where fiction is headed under Deborah Treisman. It is the debut fiction issue. That means it's the work of virtual unknowns. So, Connection listeners, join our conversation. We want to hear from you. What responsibility does the magazine have to fiction writers and readers? Is the New Yorker still one of the premier homes to fiction writing? And after all these years, does it still fulfill your expectations? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today from the NPR studios in New York is Deborah Treisman. Welcome to The Connection.
Hi.
Nice to have you here. Have you got your copy there in the studio with you?
I do have it, yeah.
The eight little Shakespeares on the front?
Yeah.
Fooling around in Central Park, it looks like eating pizza, playing on the bongo drums.
Those are our young writers with future.
Must be kind of exciting to have it in your hands finally, because this is your first sort of Treisman mark, isn't it? I mean, I know you've been deputy fiction editor and working in that office now for what, almost 6 months, but the debut fiction.
Yeah. Well, I was the deputy fiction editor for 5 years and took over with as the fiction editor after Christmas, and so sort of all the fiction since Christmas has been under my command in a sense. But this is the first full fiction issue, and we do two of these a year, which are double issues, which are not, cover to cover fiction. There's other things in there as well, but they're really a focus on fiction.
So this is the one we're supposed to leave closed and put away for summer vacation and pull out wherever we are sitting in a dock somewhere. Is that
well,
the idea?
Well, I hope it'll make for good reading at the beach, yes, and or anywhere you happen to be, dark subway,
Deborah, there was lots of talk, lots of speculation about what would happen to fiction with you in charge. This is something of a statement for you. What is the statement? What are you saying with who you want to us to read?
Well, it's always appealing to think of it as making a statement. On the other hand, there's a whole fiction department. I'm not alone. There are three other editors and two assistants who are all reading material, and we're all discussing it. And often disagreeing. So in a sense, when you're actually going into the office every day, it doesn't feel like there's a very coherent statement at all. It feels as though you're responding one by one to stories that you read and sort of assessing what works in them and what doesn't. On the other hand, when you step back and you look over a period of time, you probably do see trends. For this particular issue, the writers that we were publishing are writers who have not yet published a book. And in the case of two out of the three, this is actually their first published story. So just to come up with those three, we probably read upwards of 300 writers. There are plenty of writers out there who haven't published a book. We had to cast our web pretty wide. And in a sense, though, we're still at the mercy of what people are writing and what's going on out there. We can't create a trend. We have to recognize one and respond to it. And I actually think that the three writers are all quite different. I'm not sure there's one category I would put them in, but maybe other people will see it differently.
Well, I have the list of the three here, and you have people who have been one place and are now living somewhere else. You have a Kentucky writer living in Manhattan, a Russian writer who grew up in New York, and
Well, she actually moved to New York in 94. She's living in Staten Island now.
That's Lara Vapnyar?
Lara Vapnyar. And then Daniel Alarcón was born in Peru and grew up in Alabama. So, yeah, that was one thing that we noticed, was a fair number of writers who were doing interesting things seemed to have come from other places and to be writing in languages which maybe weren't their first language. And that's something that I've noticed in general over the last few years, whether there's a new wave of immigration or whether there's a sort of sudden flexibility on the part of people taking up writing. I'm not sure. But it has been an interesting trend to watch.
Or whether or not what you're seeing as an editor is a sort of Pico Iyer generation of writers who, you know, come from somewhere and write about something else and live somewhere else and mix cultures and ideas and languages.
Yeah, and perhaps in a sense, as a reader, I'm responding to new material. You know, I would never say that the American short story had worn itself out, but it's interesting to see stories that are set somewhere else.
Actually, we have with us on the phone one of your debut writers, Daniel Alarcón, is joining us on the line. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, good morning.
Congrats,
Deborah.
Hi, Daniel.
Do you guys have any catching up to do? I mean, checks on punctuation or any problems?
Yeah, I have a few line edits I wanted to do. I don't know if it's too late, Deborah.
A little bit too late.
Yeah.
Tell them the check's in the mail at least, though, would you, Deborah?
I hope it is. That's not my department.
Daniel, what was it like to hear word from the New Yorker magazine?
It's what you dream of, you know. It is the venue. If you are a writer that wants to get heard and you're serious about your art and your craft, that's where you want to be. So it's like winning the lottery, you know.
Now, as we mentioned a little earlier in the program, you were born in Lima, Peru, but you were pretty small when you left for Birmingham, Alabama. Is that mm-hmm. right?
That's right. I grew up in Alabama from age like 3 till 17, 18.
And now you're at the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
That's right. That's right. Which is a great experience. I mean, it's really given me the time. I think the most important thing there is time and having the opportunity to just really work on the craft and being around, you know, other writers that are just amazing. My peers are just inspiring people, and that really, you know, makes you want to work harder. And you go to workshop every week and turn in something you think is good, and you get torn to pieces, and then you go back to the lab and keep working, you know. And that's a positive experience. It's been great.
We've had a couple of your teachers, Chris Offutt and Frank Conroy, on The Connection talking mm-hmm. about their own writing. Daniel, when you want to be considered by the New Yorker, do you work that thing through until its final state at something as high level as the Iowa Writers' Workshop and send in this jewel and hope that someone like Deborah Treisman will read it? Or is it a little more formal process than that now?
Well, I think what stands out about the process that I went through was that Deborah really recognized the story. I think that had that was in, you know, wasn't in its final stage, but was far along and had potential, and she recognized something in it that she really liked, I imagine, and helped me find out what that jewel was. I don't think that the story that I turned in was publishable, but working with Deborah was really an education in how you make something that's close to what you imagined much closer. I mean, I don't think you ever, as an artist or as a writer, get there. You know, that brilliant shining idea that you have when you first sit down to start writing is never what you achieve. You know, it's always kind of a disappointment to yourself. But this story, I would say, is the one that most approximates that initial inspiration that I had, and a lot of that is due to the editing process, you know, which is something I had not experienced previously. So,
Deborah, I understand when this came to you, it was almost three times the length that it appears in the magazine. Is that right?
I think what I read was close to 20,000 words, and it ended up being close to 11, just under 11,000, I think.
Right. Okay. And what did you see? What did you see in that initial piece that made you think, yeah, maybe this one?
I saw just a very, in a sense, polished sentence writer with something to write about, and both of those things are very rare, especially in writers who haven't been around the block. Daniel had a really, I read a few of his stories, actually, and I could see that it sort of carried across beyond one story. There was a very sort of dark sense of place. What was interesting was Lima was very much a character in the story, mm-hmm. and also just a vivid and moving sense of family, which, you know, for anyone who reads the story will see. It's a story of a young man whose father has died, and the father had abandoned the boy and his mother when, you know, years before for another family. And it's sort of in about the process of coping with that very ambivalent feeling of loss a second time, but also rehashing the childhood. And at the same time, there's a subplot dealing with street clowns in Lima, and it culminates with the hero actually becoming a clown, or at least temporarily becoming a clown. So there was just a very intriguing, unusual plot as well.
Daniel, tell me from your perspective as a young writer and as a reader, what the New Yorker represents still, even today. I mean, that the, you know, you can tell me through the eyes of the people at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but I'm more interested in what it means to you when there's so many places that you could be published today.
There are, and you know, there's many, many great literary journals in this country. We're fortunate. I think we have something that approximates, you know, the minor leagues, and we have the majors, but the New Yorker is the majors. And I mean, what does it mean to me is that I read it every week, you know, and see what direction, what people are doing. I mean, at Iowa, you know, stories that are published in the New Yorker are talked about, you know, sometimes, you know, trashed, and sometimes, you know, held up as examples of what can be done. I mean, it is where the art form is showcased, you know, and I mean, if I were to name the list of writers who've been published in the New Yorker in those pages that have influenced me, you know, I think our time would run out.
So are you set now? Is your career fixed having The City of Clowns published in the New Yorker? Can you rest on your laurels?
I don't think in this particular game you can ever say that you're set or that you made it. I mean, I would like to, you know, I have a collection I would like to sell. You know, it's difficult to say if that's going to, you know, make my career or not. I hope it at least allows me the opportunity to continue writing and to hone my craft and to get better. I mean, that's what I want to do. I want to do this my whole life. This is not like a, you know, this is my life. This is what I want to do.
You can't hope for much more than the opportunity to continue writing, right?
Right. I mean, it's making a living off writing is like winning the lottery. I think there's very few people that can do it without, you know, having other sources of income, i.e. teaching or journalism. So for the moment, at least, you know, I'm not, you know, out begging in the streets. I would like not to have to.
Is it just as important to you to get a second piece in the New Yorker now and perhaps a third on down the time?
Well, like I said, this is not like a hobby for me. This is, you know, the same way someone in medical school would, you know, consider every stage of their career as important as the other. I mean, this is my whole life. This is what I plan to build my family on, and like my future, my retirement. I mean, this is everything, you know? So, yeah, the second story and the third, and I want to be publishing in the New Yorker, you know, when they're doing my collected works, you know, 30 years from now. So,
Daniel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Alarcon, one of the writers in this week's debut fiction issue. It's a piece called City of Clowns. And Connection listeners, we're talking with the new fiction editor of The New Yorker this hour. We'd like you to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is W.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. We're talking with Deborah Treisman this hour. She's the new fiction editor of The New Yorker. And this week is the magazine's debut fiction issue. That's a chance to read the work of some lesser-known writers, and also a chance to take a look at Deborah Treisman's choice of fiction that she wants us to read. Connection listeners, what kind of writing do you expect from The New Yorker? How has the fiction changed over the years? Is it still meeting your expectations as perhaps the most prestigious magazine in the literary world? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. Deborah Treisman, back to you. When you started doing what you were doing, you were just a teenager in Vancouver, British Columbia. Am I right about that?
It depends what you mean by what I'm doing.
Editing. or at least working in this business.
Well, I went to high school in Vancouver, and I suppose my first summer job was working for a publishing company there, a small press in Vancouver. But I think calling what I was doing editing is somewhat glorifying the task at hand. Mostly at that point, I was learning how to use a fax machine. But I went on after college. I worked for a time at the Threepenny Review in Berkeley, and then moved to New York, where I worked briefly at Harper's and at the New York Review of Books, and then at a literary journal called Grand Street.
And then to the New Yorker.
Yeah.
And you've done all that in a pretty short period of time. When people talk to you and about you as they do, and always start the sentence with, "Do you know how old the woman is?" I mean, it's something
getting older
that,
every day.
I mean, it seems to me to be something that the David Remnick or people at the New Yorker did quite consciously, that we need fresh eyes and we want somebody young to be taking a look at what's happening in fiction today. Do you see it that way?
I suppose you could see it that way. I mean, I think it was, to some extent, David was taking a chance. On the other hand, I was there in the office. I was an easy choice because I'd been working there already for 5 years. There's definitely, there's an interest in the office and also in our readership in seeing more young writers and more, people who are, in a sense, at the beginning of their careers. And it's really, it's an incredible pleasure to be able to balance those people with some people who are very established and sort of masters at their craft, and to have a sort of variety in what we do.
Is it a responsibility that you have to try and identify the next generation of Annie Proulx and Nick Hornby's and Saul Bellows? I mean, is that part of the brief of the office?
Yeah, well, it's part of a personal brief and part of a brief of the other people in the department. Yes, we want to be publishing new people, and we want to be helping new writers to find an audience. To the extent that we're publishing for close to a million people, that does feel like a responsibility. On the other hand, you're never going to find one story that will please a million people. There are always going to be a certain portion of the readership that will hate any given story, and a certain portion that will one hopes like that story. So you have to, in a sense, just put that out of your mind and respond on a one-by-one basis to what crosses your desk.
Is it fair criticism to go back to the 50s and 60s and say that at that time the New Yorker wasn't taking a lot of chances, that it was publishing authors who were predictable and fitting sort of within a framework of what the editors at the time felt that the readers wanted?
I suppose that's a very retrospective look at things. I think that, even the people who are now seen as classic New Yorker writers like Cheever or Updike were actually taking chances and were at the beginning of something. And I should check the books, but I think both of them were very young when they started publishing in the magazine. So in a sense, that seems like hindsight, which is somewhat grafted a perception from today onto a time when that perception really didn't exist. People love to talk about the New Yorker story as some sort of small domestic piece involving an epiphany. And that definition just gets under my skin. I find it apocryphal. It's just I sort of defy anyone to find the story that fits that definition, because I feel as though what we publish is radically different from week to week, and that, if you put George Saunders out there, he's going to be very different from what Alice Munro does the week before. And I would have a very hard time just categorizing what it is that we do.
But how do you make sense of the personal relationship that people have with the magazine? When you read about the attachment, people will talk about their recollection of where it was placed on the coffee table and when the mother read it and did the little check marks and all that sort of thing. I mean, did it? Go ahead.
There's just the weight of history there. It's been around for 78 years, so it's entirely possible that one's mother or even one's grandmother read the magazine. So it's something that from the outside, at least, in terms of, as you mentioned earlier, the font and the look of the magazine is very familiar, and it's a fixture. I also think it has to do with the weekly schedule. Most other magazines that do what The New Yorker does are monthly. And you have time, you have, in a sense, 3 weeks to detach from them, whereas we just keep it coming. And there's no way to break away. You have to keep this as a continuous relationship. People feel, I think, under pressure to get through the magazine every week.
And, I haven't finished last issue.
And stay up on what we're running. So that creates a sort of intensity of the relationship.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Marshfield, Massachusetts. Amy's on the line. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Congratulations, Ms. Treisman. I had read an interview with you in the New York Times in which you said that it was naive for writers to think that they could be pulled from the slush pile. So my question is two parts. A, is that...
Amy, what's the slush pile?
The slush pile is the blind submission.
That's the stuff that you sent in and I sent in and nobody ever wrote us back about it.
Well, they do write back. Computer-generated response.
Right, okay.
Polite. But is that true? And how often would you say you do pull from the slush pile, if in fact you do?
Well, we have what is called the slush pile, which is a selection of manuscripts which are addressed to anyone from fiction editor to the editor to William Shawn, who hasn't worked there in a long period of time. And everything sort of randomly falls into that category, though in a sense we've updated the fiction slush pile by making most of it come in by email now. It makes it a little easier to track. Every manuscript that comes in is read and is read seriously. There's absolutely no chance that I could personally read everything, but that's why we have a department. And
how many come in, Deborah?
Hundreds every week.
So 30,000 a year? Is that what we're talking about here?
That might be a little bit high, but you know, I would say 200 to 300 in a week.
Okay.
They're all read. They're all responded to. The chances of someone coming directly from that category into the magazine, they're small, but they're there. It has happened. I think it happened with Tom Jones. There are other famous stories. What more often happens is that someone has sent in a story that has promise and the writer's intriguing, and the first person who reads the story passes it along to someone else in the department who may send a personal response saying, you know, this story interests us. It's not the one for us, but please stay in touch. Then a correspondence sort of builds up and it happens that, you know, a year or two later we get a story from that same writer. And that one ends up in the magazine. Sometimes by that point, the writer has moved on and, you know, gotten an agent, which means they're no longer considered slush pile writers.
Right. But I've been told so often that agents don't represent short story writers unless they have collections.
Well, I think that really depends on the agent. It certainly wasn't true in the case of Daniel Alarcon, who was on earlier, mm-hmm. who has had an agent since, I think he was 24, who was just sending out his stories one by one. So I don't think that's the case with all writers. I mean, all agents. I think there are some who would prefer to have a book to sell because mm-hmm. it's going to be more profitable for them.
Right.
Amy, tell me,
will really foster a career.
Tell me, Amy, about your own personal expectations of fiction in The New Yorker as a reader.
As a reader.
Yeah.
Well, I am excited that Ms. Treisman has taken over the reins. I do expect to see, from what I've read, more emerging writers as well as the established writers. And there does, as she was saying, there does seem to be a real range there, which I didn't always see. So that's exciting. And it's always exciting to have new blood, even though she did work there for several years before taking over. So I am excited, and hopefully one day I will hit the lottery and appear in the pages.
Don't give up.
I won't.
All right, Amy, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go straight along to Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Dan's joining us. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I have a sort of a philosophical question. I'm a voracious reader, and I'm just beginning my career, but I'm 80, and I frequently make a comment about something that I think is really profound, and someone will say, well, where did you read that? And I'd say, well, I read it in a novel or I read it in fiction. And they say, oh, fiction, you know, as if that isn't truth. And I'd like someone, either or both of you, to comment on the relationship between the truths and fiction.
Gosh, that's a huge question. First of all, I love it that you're starting your career at 80. Is it a writing career?
Yes.
That's wonderful.
I've written my memoirs and a couple of self-published books, but I'd like, to get a little better.
Well, one of the things that I thought would have been wonderful for the debut fiction issue was to find a debut who was, over 60, say. So I'm glad there are people who are starting at that age. As for the connection between truth and fiction, fiction just seems to me a place that one can express so many things that perhaps one wouldn't put down in a reported journalistic piece. And that's one of the nice things about The New Yorker is that we offer both. And there are all kinds of relationships in the world and perceptions of the world that one can comment on in fiction and, in a sense, nowhere else, because no one will give you the time of day if you just go around spouting philosophical arguments. So if you showcase them within the context of a narrative that's appealing to read, I think people absorb them more.
What a lovely answer.
Off the top of my head, that's the best I can do.
I suppose you're married, huh?
I am, I'm afraid.
Dan, thanks for your call.
Thanks for your question.
Bye-bye.
1-800-423-8255. To Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Mary's joining us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just have a comment about a recent story and a question about it. The story was called Anything You Pawn, I Will Redeem, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. And it did some things that New Yorker fiction always does for me, which it sort of stretched me as a reader. I'm still not sure why people keep dying and disappearing in the story. But it occurred to me as I got to the end of it that, maybe they too are redeemed in some way or something, even though they don't appear again. It's a great mm-hmm. story. How did you find it, and has the author done anything else?
Well, the story was by an author called Sherman Alexie, who is, I believe, Spokane Indian, living in the Pacific Northwest. He has been published in the magazine a few times before and was actually in an issue we did a few years ago called 20 Under 40, which was the sort of 20 people under 40 who we felt were the most promising fiction writers at the time. He has a collection of stories out now, and that is one of the stories in the book, so you might want to check that out. He's just, I got so many responses to that story, and I can't really define what people responded to, except that it's the story of a homeless Indian on the streets in Seattle who's trying to retrieve his grandmother's costume, Indian costume, dancing costume,
a
pawn shop, powwow costume, yeah. And along the way, he gets and spends a huge amount of money without managing to save it. And what was just amazing to me in the story was that it managed to be funny. It's a story of a poor alcoholic homeless man, and yet it was told with such humor and grace that you just very much identified with this man and wanted him to succeed in the end. There was a sort of underlying optimism that kept you reading. But he's a wonderful writer, and you should definitely check out more of what he's done.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks for your work, too.
Mary, thanks a lot for your call. When you identify a piece like that, Deborah, is it one that you pass from or an editor passes to you and goes, this is a natural, this is going in? Or is it often that you'll get a piece like this where, in the case of Daniels, it's going to need a lot of editing before it makes it into The New Yorker?
Yeah, we get both cases. Sherman Alexie's story was edited by by the deputy fiction editor at the magazine, who's Cressida Lyshon. But that was one where we read it instantly and said, "Oh, this one's good. Yeah, we're going to do this one." Other stories, we have meetings once a week and talk about the manuscripts we've been reading, and very often it's a discussion of, what isn't working in a story. There's something here that's intriguing enough for us to keep going. But somehow something's also not working, whether it's the ending's not satisfying or there's some unanswered questions in the story or a character's not coming through clearly, or whether it's just that it feels either too long or too short for what it's trying to do. We discuss those, and very often we'll go back to the writer and make suggestions or talk about the possibilities for fixing those problems.
And would the suggestions be, I mean, is there a line that you're very careful not to cross in terms of saying, you know, try this or try that? I mean, you don't want to impose your idea of what the story ought to be on someone who's a writer, right?
Yeah, and you very much don't want to do anything that will affect the voice of the story. You don't want to intrude on what the writer's doing. On the other hand, I found that almost every writer out there wants a reader, and they want the reader to respond and say what the reader is getting from the story. So in a sense, I function as a reader, and I go back and say, I'm not quite getting it. And that shows them where the problems are. And usually they're, you know, all the writers that we work with are wonderful professionals, and they instantly see it and they say, oh, well, I need to do that. That's clear. You know, and every now and then you make a suggestion and they say, well, that's not at all what I want to do with the story. And that works too. So it's always kind of a collaborative effort.
Except that you've got the big club. You're at the New Yorker and they're trying to get into it.
Well, if they've got a good story, they can take it anywhere they want to. So, you know, we're trying to make things as strong as they can be and still put them out.
And is there competition out there? I don't want to go through a list of other places that you look or other magazines that you read, but mm-hmm. is the New Yorker no longer just the place to go?
Well, there are, as Daniel was saying, there are a ton of places in this country to publish fiction, and a lot of, you know, the immediate, not competitors, but other magazines in the same world, such as Harper's or The Atlantic, do wonderful stories. But there's also a whole range of smaller literary journals, which we try and keep reading to sort of, in a sense, sometimes you get writers who think they're not good enough, or who just imagine they'll be ignored at The New Yorker, they won't get the attention, and don't even try. And sometimes you want to keep an eye on those people and see what they're doing in other places.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Deborah Treisman, new fiction editor at The New Yorker. And the debut fiction issue is on newsstands near you, dated June 16th, 23rd. Look for the little Shakespeare's on the cover and you'll know what we're talking about. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join our conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fox Relocation Management.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And if you are a subscriber to The New Yorker, you'll already know that the debut fiction issue is at your door or on its way, and it's on the newsstands as well. The new fiction editor at The New Yorker is Deborah Treisman. She's our guest this hour, and we're talking a little bit about her vision for where fiction is and where it's going in the magazine. Deborah, you're not just a vessel into which people put their submissions and then sort through them and decide which ones to use. You're also on the lookout for certain types of work. What is it that you'd like to see more of in the magazine?
Gosh, well, I never, I don't really think about it in those terms. In a sense that as opposed to being types, I think what we see are good stories that, mm-hmm. that succeed in doing what they're trying to do. But very often those are quite different things. What, say, Antonia Nelson is trying to do is quite different from what Haruki Murakami is trying to do. When I first took the job, a lot was made of the fact that I also have done translations. And for a while, I think everyone expected to see only 15-year-old Vietnamese writers in the magazine. there's really nothing that narrow about our approach. It's wonderful, I think, that we've been seeing more writing from other countries, and there's no reason why that shouldn't have a place in The New Yorker. On the other hand, there's no reason why John Updike, who's published with the magazine for decades, should not go on being published in the magazine. So it's really, if there's anything that I'm looking for, it's variety and, you know, stories that succeed, that fulfill their ambitions, whatever those ambitions may be.
What about the mix of boys and girls, men and women writing? Is that important to you?
Well, I would absolutely love to have it be 50-50. That would tell me something about the world that was very hopeful and optimistic. It's you know, it's hard to do that, and you can't read with that in mind, and you can't assess stories based on the gender of the person who wrote them. It seems to me that what we get is still about, in terms of manuscripts that come in, we're getting about two-thirds, or maybe even a little more than that, are from men. So in a sense, if we were 50-50, we would be privileging women for that reason. On the other hand, what makes me hopeful is that in among the younger writers, I think I'm even seeing more by women than by men under a certain age. So I think things are changing. We're sort of at the point of a shift. You'll notice in the debut issue, we have three stories by women and one by a man. So there seems to me in the younger generation to be sort of a move towards more women writing.
And are you seeing anything different in the style of the work that's coming in from young writers? Not necessarily women writers or men writers, but any kind of a shift or a trend that you're seeing that you either want to encourage or push along a little bit?
Well, it's funny. In a sense, I think I've already said that we are at the mercy of what people are doing out there in the wider world. And I've seen, again, a huge variety, even among younger writers. You get someone like, in our last debut issue, we published pieces by Jonathan Safran Foer and Gabe Hudson, who were doing more comic or satirical writing. In this issue, we have pieces by Heather Clay and Laura Vapnir, who are doing quite realistic, not traditional, but it's more about observation than about humor in their writing. So you see trends, but you don't. They never last very long, and there's a tendency to kind of group people together in ways that maybe are a little bit forced. And when in fact there's just a few hundred people out there who are writing what they want to write, it doesn't have very much to do with each other.
And humor used to form such an important part of the magazine. I remember. I mean, I'm a big fan of James Thurber, and was going through the list of writers last night, and didn't see him in the fiction category, and didn't see him and then found him in the artist category. I don't know whether or not that he could live in virtually every one, perhaps except nonfiction. There is a little bit less of that, isn't there? That style of humor?
In a way, it's been somewhat split up in the magazine, and we have a column called Shouts and Murmurs, which are shorter pieces that are written to be humorous, that are comic pieces, where we have Woody Allen, Steve Martin,
right.
David Sedaris, many other very funny writers. Then in fiction, we have writers who write short stories that are funny. And I'm not sure if that division is a natural one. Sometimes it's not quite clear if something should run as fiction or as a Shouts and Murmurs. But there are quite a few very funny fiction writers out there. George Saunders is one, Donald Antrim, T.C. Boyle. We see people who really do make us laugh. But in the process, they're also writing wonderful stories, which is a slightly different thing.
Let's go back to our telephone lines. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mike's joining us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I'd like to ask your guest if she knows whether or not some of the giants historically writing short stories like de Maupassant had either editors reviewing their work or agents promoting it.
Well, the agent system in France is still pretty minimal, so I don't think de Maupassant had any agent. But on the other hand, I think that the editing tradition is quite long-standing. You do read historically about writers having intense relationships with their editors, and that's book editors. I mean, probably not so much with magazine editors, since magazines were less common. But there's a long tradition of having a first reader who assesses what you write, and that being your first trusted ear.
Are you thinking, Mike, that the idea of having agents working on behalf of authors is in some way tipping the balance of the system?
No, not really. I just wondered if this is a relatively new phenomenon, and also whether people, individualists like de Maupassant, would tolerate anybody even suggesting that their work be altered.
Well, that's really writer by writer. My experience, I've had some writers who can't stand to see a comma moved, and some writers who want help completely restructuring something. So that, I think, has probably always been a question of personal work process.
I'm a great fan of the late S.J. Perlman, and I remember reading in one of his memoirs that he wouldn't tolerate, he felt he was such a craftsman and was so personally involved in his work that he wouldn't tolerate anybody altering it in the slightest.
Well, there are people who are perfect craftsmen and who get altered very little. And then there are people who feel the need for input. So I think there probably always has been a variety.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Mike. To Madison, Wisconsin now. Mike's on the line. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I'm curious how they picked such great but strange ones as recent ones, The Teachings of Don Fernando and The Real Heroes Are Dead. They were stories that really resonated with me because I lived that life. But how do you get feedback about something like that? Did others like it?
Well, you know what? I think those were actually before I was at the magazine.
I'm not familiar with either of them either, Mike. But was there something about them that spoke to you as a reader? Something that you can tell us about for those of us who haven't read them?
It took a very gutsy editor to pick something like that, and that's why I respect the New Yorker. The Real Heroes Are Dead is about a guy who died in the September attack on the Twin Towers, and The Teachings of Don Fernando is even stranger. It was about a Mexican drug informant in Northwest Mexico.
Could be that these are both nonfiction pieces, right?
You're talking nonfiction pieces. Yeah, that's why I'm not recognizing
the
title. Okay,
sorry.
But that's fine. I also work on nonfiction. I didn't work on. Now I know which pieces you mean. There's also, you know, on the nonfiction side, a real effort to push the bar in terms of reporting and in terms of finding human narratives within larger news stories, and that's something that I think the magazine has always tried to do. I'm glad that those two had an effect.
What's the advantage, Deborah, in separating the two? Just listening to you talk about the human narrative, I'm thinking of John McPhee, who's another favorite of mine. And, you know, there's times when I could care less whether or not the story he's telling me is fiction or nonfiction. He's such a good storyteller. Why have the division at the editor level?
You mean why have some people who work on one thing and not on another?
Yeah, why aren't you, an editor of writing as opposed to an editor of fiction or an editor of nonfiction?
Well, I think that's actually just a question of logistics. It would be too complicated to have fiction coming in to the 10 or 12 editors at the magazine and having us all get together and agree about something.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, fiction has been separated off just because it's easier to have a few fewer hands in the broth. But on the other hand, we all also edit nonfiction. So in a sense, the approach to the writing, I think, is quite different. And I like doing both. I feel as though it sort of works different parts of my brain because what you're doing with the writing is quite different.
Will the magazine, at least to your understanding of it, continue to have that kind of news magazine quality that David has brought to? I guess Tina Brown brought a little bit of it, but it seems to be a little bit more interested in staying with stories that are current, John Lee Anderson stuff.
There's been an awful lot of news lately.
Yeah.
There have been, you know, what's been happening in the world that's been most important has been linked to things that are happening and changing every day. And in a sense, I think it's always been the goal of the magazine to deal with what's happening in the world. And perhaps there's just a speed of change these days, which is different from what it used to be. I think the goal is to keep the magazine very timely. And, you know, it's a luxury to have a weekly in the sense that you can get stories out while they're still relevant. On the monthly timetable, you're often coming out several weeks after something's happened, and the approach has to be different. But we've had very good responses to, as you mentioned, John Lee Anderson's reports from Baghdad.
Was there a little callus on the outside of your fist from banging on the table saying, you know, we got to keep the fiction in there. We got to make space for that.
Well, sometimes when there's a lot of news, it takes up a lot of space in the magazine, and then we end up running shorter stories. But all that means is that we have to keep on hand a strong inventory of stories of all different lengths.
There are fewer now, are there not? Fewer fiction pieces than there used to be in The New Yorker? I mean, not, setting aside the fiction issues that come out twice a year, what do you do, one or two?
Well, there's one story an issue. There was a time when there were two stories. On the other hand, it was often true that the second story was more what we now call shouts and murmurs or a casual, that the one story was sort of a solid, substantial narrative and the other one was more a piece of humor or something a little bit lighter. So in a sense, I think we're still doing that, but we're categorizing it slightly differently. As you said, you don't really care if it's called fiction or nonfiction, so long as it's a good read.
And as an editor, when you get the kind of feedback for a story that we were talking about, Alexei's work, someone says, gosh, that was just, I mean, we imagine you as someone who's, you know, so confident about judgment that, yes, we like this, no, we don't, that you already know. But there must be some comfort and affirmation when you get the feedback that you do about the stories that you have chosen.
Well, the best part of the job is actually giving people something they really want to read and feel better after reading. So, yeah, it's absolutely wonderful to hear that. And again, it's a luxury of The New Yorker that we reach so many people that you are more likely to get a response and not to feel that you're working in the dark.
So you're going to be a long time in that corner office?
If they let me stay, then I'll stay.
Deborah, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Deborah Treisman is the new fiction editor at The New Yorker. We heard earlier in the program from Daniel Alarcon, whose story City of Clowns is in this week's debut fiction issue. And if you're interested, Connection listeners, in taking a peek at that story, you can find it online on our website, theconnection.org. But if you want to find the rest of the stories, you're going to have to pay for a copy of the magazine. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com. By Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and